Go. Hi, Dad.
Hello, Henry.
How are you doing up there in Boston?
Well, we are having a massive snow day. My children are home from school, and I am home from school. Tufts University canceled classes today, which I have to admit instilled a certain giddiness in me. You know, I was grumpy at the idea of having to go to school, but my kids didn't. And then suddenly when I found out it was a snow day, I'm much happier now.
Well, that's all good. Unfortunately, here in D.C., we haven't even got the light sprinkling that you need in order to declare a snow emergency in the district. So George Washington University, regrettably, is open, and I will be teaching classes even.
I'm sorry about that. Yes, I remember when I was in D.C., I always loved the snow emergencies. You know, you got, you know, actual accumulation. You could see white on the ground, and naturally, the entire city shut down.
Yeah, we do not know how to deal with snow. And it's weird because we do get reasonable snowfalls here. It's like the combination of the worst of the weather of the south and the north. You know, you get these miserable summers, but the winters aren't that great either. So go for it.
Well, it's all Thomas Jefferson's fault. Remember that.
Well, you know, sort of, I guess I'm Irish, so I figure it's all, you know, sort of, it's you guys' fault that you decided to build your national capital in the city with some of the least pleasant weather to be found in the eastern
city. Well, it wasn't a city when it was built, was the problem. It was, you know, it's a constructed city is the thing. And this was that compromise.
I guess that's right. So anyway, that gives us a kind of a very sort of backhanded way of sliding into the topic of the elections, which I figure have been the topic of most blogging ads for the last several weeks at least. But I think political scientists have something slightly different and a different take on this stuff, and I wonder what you think, and maybe tell me what you think, and then I'll slide into my field.
I think one of the things that's interesting to note is basically how not just political scientists, but a lot of people got New Hampshire just completely wrong. You know, the media, you know, was forecasting it as an Obama victory, you know, potentially double digits. Both the Obama and the Clinton campaigns in particular thought it was going to be not double digit victory, I mean, but the Clinton people thought they were going to lose. The polls all show this, which of course, you know, the fact that the polls were wrong, this combined with a lot of, you know, basically this past decade series of polling and a few mistakes, you know, leads to questions about whether or not polling is accurate or not. And I think, you know, in the wake of the primary, there's also this question about the role of political prediction markets as well, and whether or not they're any kind of useful guide or, you know, sort of useful oracle, for lack of a better word, in terms of providing any kind of insight, you know, looking forward.
Well, I think there are a couple of issues there. You know, the first issue is, I think, the issue about polling data and whether it is accurate or inaccurate. And I think that there are a whole bunch of things which were going on, which were particular to the New Hampshire race. But also there's this more general issue that our more public opinion-focused colleagues are increasingly worried about, which is that it's more and more difficult to actually get people on the phone for interview surveys these days. A lot of people use cell phones. And thus the people who you get who are willing to talk to you on landlines tend perhaps to be a not especially representative sample of the overall population. So you try to apply all of these fixes in order to try to minimize the distortion that this causes, but you end up still sort of having to engage, I think, in at least some degree of educated guesswork. And this is a real problem that I think that these people are facing. And on the prediction markets thing, you know, so I guess this confirms some research that Andrew Gelman was pointing to on his blog a couple of weeks ago. Andrew is a very well-known political scientist, but more than that, he's a statistician. And he basically argues, and I think that this is right, that prediction markets do play an important and interesting role, but basically they don't have any magical wand that they can wave. They give you a very nice sort of summary statistic of what the sort of general consensus is about something at a particular point in time. And as a result, when the general consensus is going to be badly wrong, as it was indeed in New Hampshire, political prediction markets aren't going to necessarily tell you all that much that you wouldn't have been able to guess from reading the blogs, reading the newspapers, seeing the commentators on cable TV. And the tracking between the prediction market and the general consensus seems to be pretty clear. The moment at which which the prediction markets begin to tank on Obama and begin to hype up Clinton again are exactly the moments at which the exit polls begin to break, at which point, you know, some new information breaks into the market
right.
that everybody is aware of, not only the people who are trying to speculate.
Well, I would say two things. On the polling side, I'm not sure, I mean, you're correct that, I mean, this is a growing issue methodologically for our polling colleagues, which is, you're right, an increasing number of percentage of Americans rely on cell phones as their primary means of, is their primary phone number there, you know, basically off the you can't call those using a poll. The one thing, though, I have to wonder is whether this really should have skewed the New Hampshire results, because...
No, I agree. This is a general point.
I mean,
I'm sorry, I said that, but I maybe didn't emphasize
right,
it.
Right, and if anything, the bias should have cut the other way, because presumably, you know, cell phone use is probably much higher among younger, you know, under 30 population.
Yeah.
And the exit polls, which were relatively reliable, showed that though that population skewed Obama over Clinton. That bias should have cut the other way. I have to admit, I think what happened in New Hampshire was, to some extent, the sort of Mickey Kaus observation. This is his, you know, famous filer faster thesis, which is the argument that people will incorporate information much more quickly than they used to. They process information, and it hits, it goes from news event to, you know, consuming the information much more quickly than it used to, you know, 10, 20 years ago. And I think that's combined with an additional phenomenon, which is a large section of the turnout was incredibly high. It was incredibly high in Iowa, and it was also relatively high in New Hampshire. I think that's, you know, the fact that turnout was high doesn't necessarily mean that the people who were voting were paying a lot of attention to the campaign 24 mm-hmm. hours before they actually went in to vote. So in other words, I think what makes this sort of campaign really relatively interesting, or this might be a new dynamic to political campaigns, is that literally what happens in the previous news cycle has a much more dramatic effect on voter swings than what would have happened prior to that. In other words, the people's voting preferences are much less fixed for a certain segment, for a pivotal segment of the population going into the voting booth. So that I kind of have to wonder, because and this leads to the question of, well, even so, what caused the swing? Why were the polls so wrong? Because the exit poll was relatively accurate. I mean, the exit poll, if I remember correctly, had Obama 39, Clinton 38, and it wound up being, you know, a 3-point differential the other way, which is within the margin of error, correct?
Yeah, I think so.
But the polls leading up to that were wildly off. They were, you know, 5 to 10% Obama lead. And so the interesting question is, what happened in the previous 24 hours that caused that swing?
I think that's fair. And I should say, when I was talking about the polls, I said that, but I maybe didn't make it clear enough that this was a general problem that I think we're facing rather than a specific New Hampshire. But what you're pointing to, and I think this is an interesting way of thinking about it. You can think about this in two ways. You can think about it in terms of what were the specific things that set off the change from Obama to Clinton at the last moment. And some of the evidence seems to suggest that the Obama support remained relatively stable.
Right.
What happened is that a whole bunch of people who were undecided or who sort of perhaps weren't going to turn up at the polls decided to come and decided to vote for Clinton. But maybe the more interesting question is the structural question that you pose, which is, does this mean that we're going to get a much more unpredictable campaigning season in general than we would otherwise, because the structure of how people pay attention to these things has changed, and because what happens, as you say, in the last 24 hours before polling opens may be more important than what's gone before? And it seems to me you can cut that. There are two possible ways in which you could think about this. One would be to think about this as being a semi-random process, if not necessarily right up to the end, at least to the point where we get all of those major primaries clumping together in a big, and important way. The second way is that you might think about this as being a path-dependent process, which is to say that you get a lot of noise at the beginning, and that noise may skew things very substantially one way or the other, but later events tend to have a much less important impact on the way in which it skews than earlier events. So, you know, so it could well be that we see less noise happening during the next two or three, the South Carolina, the Nevada, and the Michigan primary, although that doesn't matter so much on the Democratic side, obviously. And it could well be that we actually begin to see some of the dynamics that some pundits were predicting, which is to say we see an actual uncertainty. We see the table being set for the sort of the major burst of primaries that we get in a few weeks' time, in a way that really dictates and dominates the choices. So in other words, it may be that this kind of random last 24-hour thing is going to be much more important in the first couple of primaries than it is going to be a couple of weeks down the road.
I mean, my guess is it's going to stay important until February 5th. I think it could.
Yeah.
Because the problem is that. You know, and again, now we're trying to predict the future, and clearly we're not terribly good at that. You have to think that, you know, it's going to be relatively close in Nevada, and my hunch is that it's also going to be relatively close in South Carolina. So as a result, my guess is Obama gets a slight boost from these next two states, but nothing to, you know, make him the clear front runner again. In which case, there's still massive uncertainty heading into February 5th.
Yeah.
So, you know, something actually could happen in the 24 hours before the election, even hell, just the night before. You know, again, I'm of the opinion, for example, that when the Clinton emoting. You know, the night before, I think that did have an effect because it also crystallized a whole series of things leading up to that about whether or not Clinton had been unfairly attacked for being a woman or, you know, showing her softer side, what have you. I'm surprised no one's mentioned the possibility of the Gloria Steinem op-ed didn't have an effect. A fair number of people in New Hampshire get the New York Times, and I have to wonder whether that had an effect as well. The op-ed, you know, basically saying it's a shame that we're not voting for the woman. A quick point about the prediction markets also, which is, I think, I would say two things about the prediction markets. The first is that sort of seeing the wild swings, I'm beginning to think that, you know, I keep thinking of that line that William Goldman wrote in a book called Adventures of the Screen Trade, which is nobody knows anything. That's his guide to Hollywood, and you know, part of that is what's going on to some extent now with the primaries, which is nobody does know anything. It is such a wide open race now that, and because there is no clear front runner, I mean, there's no sitting president running, there's no sitting vice president running. It's the first time I think since '52. You know, it's an incredibly unusual situation, and so this might be one of those things where political scientists are, you know, at a really deep disadvantage. So that's why the political prediction markets are swinging so widely. The second thing is that I kind of wonder, this is one of those interesting experiments where, unfortunately, the prediction markets are mostly experimental. The Iowa electronic market is a relatively shallow market. I'm not sure how deep in trade, which is another one, but it's offshore. And it would almost be, you know, one of the experiments I'd like to see, is that if you actually got more participation in these markets, as the markets got deeper, would they also then become more sophisticated?
Well, there's an interesting, and Andrew Gelman, I think, had some interesting speculations along those lines, which is to say that there are problems both ways, which is to say that if you get a minimal amount of money sloshing around in the market, you don't necessarily have enough knowledge to really capitalize on things. If you get too much money sloshing around, you may actually get some odd incentives pointing the other way. Not so much perhaps necessarily with national elections, although maybe this will be true here as well, but you may actually get people trying to sort of push deliberately to lose or to fail at certain things because they can then make out like gangbusters.
Right.
On the market. That I don't think is going to apply for national elections where the stakes are so high and the incentives of the people involved tend to point pretty strongly in other directions. But getting back to the political science thing, it seems to me that William Goldman has one thing to say, which is pretty interesting. Another interesting thing is Socrates. You know, there's a famous story about Socrates searching through Athens to find the wisest man in Athens, you know, because the oracle at Delphi had said that Socrates was, and Socrates wanted to find somebody wiser. And eventually Socrates finishes up figuring out that he's the wisest, because he's the only person who's prepared to recognize how stupid and how limited his knowledge actually is. And this may be there might be something to be said about political science and political scientists here, which is that the kinds of stuff that we tend, the kinds of things that we tend to look at, tend to be structural issues. You know, so we tend to try to figure out what kinds of structural variables influence the ways in which things work out this way rather than that way, which can maybe give you a little bit of an edge if you're betting or if you're trying to predict what's going to happen in the future. But it also means that you have to recognize that there's going to be a lot of noise in your models, all of these unexpected events, which, as you say, maybe this time are even more important than they usually are. And as a result, at least me as a political scientist, I haven't indulged in anything that could seriously be considered as horse race predictions, because frankly, I know that I don't know that I don't know enough to be able.
You know
to
your own fallibility.
What's going to happen?
Yeah.
And also because you're a political scientist, there are there's a temptation there that people sometimes take you seriously, even if they don't realize that you're an IR scholar who has absolutely no business whatsoever in pontificating about this stuff. They sometimes, you know, so you've got this professional gravitas which you want to avoid besmirching by pretending to know more things than you actually do.
Oh yes, you know, and thank God we don't do that on our blogs or anything. But
never.
No. I mean, this is the political scientist lament. It's the equivalent of the economist who, you know, he's at a cocktail party and immediately someone asks him about the stock market and what it's going to do. When, you know, he's studying something else, he's not going to have any clue. And even those who study the stock market won't necessarily. They know that it's a random walk. So yes, I mean, you're right. I mean, political scientists, you know, the reputable ones at least should generally show a little humility. And you're right. I mean, you know, we can do some sophisticated analysis. The paper that I think Gelman linked to, for example, showed that, you know, in this debate about prediction markets versus polling, you know, prediction markets enthusiasts always like to point out that they do better than sort of snapshot polls at the same time. But the paper pointed out that if you employ, you know, any kind of sophisticated analysis about how national polls track, you know, from an early parts of an election cycle to the end, you can actually still outperform the prediction markets. So there is still a useful service to be performed, I think, by political scientists, but it's only, you know, sort of a marginal improvement over, and I think that's where we have to leave that, I believe.
Yeah, I think that's right. But getting back to, and let's move on to the second issue I wanted to talk about, which is getting back to what you said about the way in which Hillary Clinton's not quite bursting into tears things may have had an important impact. And you suggested that it may have had an important impact because effectively it encapsulated this whole discourse about whether she was being treated unfairly as a woman, all of these different things that have gone into the campaign before that. And that suggests, you know, so effectively what she was doing in a sense, she was speaking, she was communicating at least in a semi-coded way, whether deliberately or whether by virtue of just being overcome by the time. She was communicating in a certain way, communicating certain perceptions of the race, and this was having having real consequences for the ways in which voters behave. And from talking to you just before we began the conversation, you clearly think that this is something which is changing in some interesting and important ways, and especially so given the dynamics of the Democratic race with the various back and forths between the Clinton campaign and the Obama campaign over race, over gender, over the Iraq War, and Obama's voting record. Yeah. Do you want to go into that in a little more detail?
Well, I mean, what I found interesting was that, you know, I mean, and let me step at the beginning that I actually think part of the reason that Clinton got the bump from that is that I thought the media coverage the week, you know, between Iowa and New Hampshire was pretty much, you know, long knives out waiting for Clinton to, you know, self-destruct. And I think that was part of it also. And then there was the debate where, you know, it appeared like Obama and Edwards were ganging up on Clinton. And then there was the sort of emotive moment, which I actually do think was spontaneous. I don't think she planned it. But, you know, it was affecting. And what's interesting now is also that I think the Clinton campaign is going to pay a small price in South Carolina for things they said during that week. You know, Bill Clinton described the Obama, depending upon who you know, listen, you talk about Obama's campaign either as a fairy tale or Obama's Iraq plan as a fairy tale, depending upon who you listen. You know, Clinton used the false hope characterization of Obama's campaign. You know, and now, you know, it was attacking the Iraq record. And then, you know, I think most significantly, Hillary Clinton was talking about the civil rights movement. I don't even know how this came up, But, you know, someone talked about Martin Luther King, and Clinton pointed out, yes, but it was Lyndon Johnson as president who passed the Civil Rights Act. That's what mattered, you know, which I think is telling a whole variety of things. But anyway, and then, she, you know, the very next time, she next campaign stop, she tried to clarify. A lot of Clinton surrogates have talked about, you know, Obama shucking and jiving, I think, was one phrase. Donald Johnson, or is it Robert Johnson, I'm sorry, the head of BET, yesterday made allusions to Obama's, you know, drug past, you know, when he used various recreational drugs. And what was interesting was I thought the Obama response to that one in particular was an accusation that Clinton was rewriting history was the phrase, which I thought was a brilliant sort of coded message because it was talking about that specific incident, but it was also clearly alluding to all the various Clinton efforts to rewrite the civil rights movement in the 1960s. And my guess is you're going to see Obama surrogates use that phrase as well. That's a coded reference to see what the Clintons are doing. They're trying to rewrite what happened, you know, during the 60s and the civil rights movement. You know, and this can get ugly. I mean, one of the things I'm kind of curious about is to what extent do, you know, are the candidates trying to speak in code to, you know, their key target groups? But I have a bigger question, which is whether or not this is even possible now. You know, I think it used to be a much easier thing to do. The problem is that we're now living in such a media-saturated environment that anyone who tries to do this is going to get caught. And in fact, even people who weren't necessarily intentionally trying to do it, you know, they just sort of subliminally did it, are going to get caught doing it. You know, one example, I mean, during the 2004 campaign, I still remember this, watching the debate between Bush and Kerry, George Bush was asked about, you know, judges and so on and so forth. And, you know, Bush starts outlining his judicial philosophy, and he brings up Dred Scott, which was a bizarre, you know, which was a bizarre thing to bring up, and you couldn't figure it out until you realize that Dred Scott is apparently code among, you know, very conservative judicial circles for, you know, I'm going to overturn Roe v. Wade. And that, you know, got out there, you know, after about a week. And, you know, it's 4 years later, and, you know, these are things now. I unfortunately am on the email list for Hillary Clinton's press office, so I get all of their press releases. I got four of them. Yes.
Happily, I'm
not. What'd you say?
Happily,
man, let me tell you, I wish I was you. Anyway, so yeah, I got four of them yesterday, and it was clearly they were all of them dealing with Obama, and a couple of them dealing with the Johnson comment about Obama. So the fact is that the cycle is moving, you know, is moving more quickly. So what I'm wondering is whether or not this speaking in political code is going to be able to work, unless you're doing it literally like hours before the primary.
It's a very good question. I think a lot of that depends upon the question we were looking at, trying to talk about earlier, which is the question of how much attention people are actually paying.
Yeah.
Because it's pretty clear to me that elites have a much better idea of what the codes that people are speaking in than they might have had 2 to 4 years back. And this is in part because of blogs and the blogosphere. You know, for example, this Mike Huckabee thing, you know, I don't know if you read about this. He has this use on his website of the word vertical, you know, so I'm going to have a vertical presidency, which seems, you know, sort of like something bizarre or crazy to somebody like me who's not a Baptist Christian, but which has apparently some strong resonance. Basically, what you're saying is that you're going to privilege the vertical relationship with God and the what God's law is, rather than the horizontal relations that you get among human beings. And that's something which I would have never, you know, I wouldn't have known in 1,000 years, obviously, because I don't read Baptist theological tracts for my spare time reading. But how much of this penetrates beyond the elites is something which I'm not quite sure about. And I think that there are a couple of things. It seems to me that some of the language which Hillary Clinton has used, and Josh Marshall has a good post on this, may or may not be, and through speaking in code, may or may not be her trying to get messages across which are subliminal or not so subliminal. Certainly some of the messages that her surrogates have been using have not even slightly been subliminal.
Yeah.
You know, when you have Andrew Cuomo making that shuck and jive comment, when you have, you know, sort of that Johnson and sort of those comments which pretty clearly were referring, despite his later denials, to Obama's drug use, this is something which is not encoded at all. And it seems to me that the stuff which is more direct is sort of much more unpredictable than it was in the past. It's the more genuinely coded references, the Dred Scott type stuff, the vertical type stuff, which I suspect probably still isn't penetrating beyond the skulls of a relatively small number of media and commenters and people who are following these debates. And probably that kind of coded dog whistle message still does get through to some extent, because it's not, nobody's going to talk about vertical and Huckabee on the talk shows, whereas people are going to talk about shucking and jiving.
No, that's a fair. I mean, that's an interesting point. I mean, you're right. We could almost declare a political science, observation here, which is the further away a supporter is from the candidate, the less in code they will speak. The more removed you are from the campaign, but even if you support the campaign, the more blunt you can be in terms of the language you're going to use. And it's interesting. I like the idea that that might crowd out. It's possible that could crowd out the more coded appeals by candidates. On the other hand, the counter to that is, if there's one thing that's clear, it's that media coverage likes a theme. If they see three incidents happen, that's a trend. And so it can be the case sometimes that if someone on the fringes of a campaign says something outrageous, it allows the media to say, well, they said this, but really, if you see the past statements for the past 2 weeks, we see that the husband of the campaign the candidate said this. The candidate actually said this. These are more subtle appeals, but to the same message. So, in some ways, these things might be complementary. It's not clear there's a crowding out effect. It might be the case that if someone says something terrifically outrageous, it highlights the issue all over again.
And it's sort of like the George Allen incident with there are a whole bunch of journalists going around looking for the smoking gun proof that he was racist, and this gave them the hook they could hang their story upon. I use John Edwards with the grooming video, which it's the same basic thing. You have these journalists out there; they very often have a narrative in their head about what's happening, and they're looking for the hook that they can hang on.
Yeah, as much as I like to critique the media about this is how all people are. We're all hardwired to look for these kinds of narratives, and we're going to look for confirming evidence, we're going to somewhat dismiss disconfirming evidence, and unless there's a real radical event that, throws everyone for a loop, that's the way, unfortunately, things go, which is not, to again quote William Goldman, life's not fair.
The other side of that, though, is that I think that some of this, and I had a conversation recently with a couple of journalists about this, some of this I think has to do specifically with the way that the U.S. press works, which is to say that you must have had the same thing, that you get a journalist calling up, and the journalist is looking for general insights on this, that, or the other, or so they say, but they're clearly looking for a specific quote that says X. And the reason for this is that in a U.S. Newsroom, you cannot make an opinionated statement unless you do it by surrogate.
You have to do it by proxy, exactly.
Unless you can get renowned political science professor Dan Dressner to say it, you can't say it in your article.
Right.
Whereas if you were a British or a European journalist, you probably could get away with it. So I think that this is a somewhat similar phenomenon, that if you have a narrative in your head that says that X person is really behaving in a Y way, you need to have that hook. You need to have that thing in order to persuade your editors that you can do this.
Yeah, my favorite. I still remember this. In about 2004, I got a call from a reporter who wanted to talk to me, who began the conversation with, "Well, as a Bush hater, I would like to get this." Which, fine, whatever, but it was just sort of one of those, it was clear that the reporter wanted as a Republican, I condemn President Bush for X kind of quote. And it was just sort of amusing that, they were that overt about it. I'm not sure that the difference between European and American reporting is going to be that stark, because even in the European context, there's still going to be the look for expertise quotes, if nothing else, confirming what the reporter thinks. It might be a little more sotto voce, or might not quite be as the demand for that sort of thing might not be as high, but I think you're still going to see it in the European press as well.
But apparently, at least according to the conversation that I was part of, not to the same extent. This was a specific discussion between two people who had two journalists who had different perceptions of the different systems.
Well, let me ask you a question
who had experience in both.
Before we move on to our next topic, the one thing I'm wondering is, look, for the past week now, or since New Hampshire, the Democrats, you know, particularly been in kind of this kind of race-gender question of, you know, what's more important, having the black candidate get the nomination or the female, you know, the woman candidate getting the nomination. I think this is going to be, I don't think this is going to die down anytime soon unless there's some kind of news, you know, peg that can sort of, you know, leap this kind of thing. After the South Carolina primary, there's going to be clear questions about whether or not the African-American community voted with Obama, what were the reasons for it, and so on and so forth. I'm not sure, in the long term, is this going to be debilitating for the Democratic nominee with whoever wins it?
Maybe. I think it depends on the depths of the bitterness.
Yeah.
Because if people start saying really unforgivable things to each other, that could sort of have some significant impact down the road. But I'm guessing probably not, at least on the basis of what has happened to date. You see sort of leaders in the black community clearly sort of not quite sure which side they should jump
right.
in on. I get the impression that there's a lot of bitterness, but that a lot of that bitterness primarily is personal. A lot of people on the Clinton campaign in particular who have perceived this as effectively being a coronation and who are outraged that somebody like Obama should come along and should complicate what seemed to be their smooth and easy path to power.
Yeah.
And that may translate into long-term difficulties for the coalition of the Democrats in the future. But frankly, I would be much more worried if I were a Republican about what's going to happen with Mike Huckabee. So that either he loses, in which case there's going to be a lot of bitterness, I think, among Christian fundamentalists who feel that he's probably been stopped by the money guys, or he's going to somehow, which I think is still possible, win the nomination, in which case I think it's going to be Barry Goldwater squared in terms of the impact that's going to have. I don't think that he has a hope in hell of getting anywhere near the presidency, and I suspect that he would have a pretty damaging long-term impact on the Republican Party. But, you know, I'm not a Republican, so what do I
mean? I think my take is it actually depends on who wins and who loses in terms of the nomination. For example, I think if Clinton, and this is the interesting thing, if Clinton wins the nomination, I think it's in Obama's style to date, and just sort of his character, it leads me to think that he's not going to necessarily hold a grudge. I mean, you know, he'll probably hold some kind of grudge. But, you know, my guess is that the way he's run his campaign is such that he's going to endorse, you know, Obama. And it's not like African Americans necessarily, are going to suddenly decide to switch to the Republican vote. So on the other hand, I think if Clinton loses, as you point out, the bitterness on this campaign has mostly been from the Clinton side. You know, when you see like reporters talking to people in both campaigns, and again, it's because, and that was the impression I actually got from the video, clip where Clinton was emoting. She was clearly frustrated that in her mind, it's not just that she should get the nomination; she's clearly entitled to it. She somehow, earned it in a way that no other candidate possibly has, and it's just baffling to her that there could be any kind of impediment to this. So if Obama wins, I'm going to be very intrigued to see whether the Clinton people, manage to swallow their pride, as it were, and offer their full-throated support for Obama, or whether there's still going to be some residual bitterness. On the GOP side, as a Republican, the thing about Huckabee is twofold. The first is, you're right, I mean, there's this point about whether Huckabee scares, some of the interests in the Republican Party. There is also, however, frankly, a competence question with Huckabee. You've read I don't know if you've read the Foreign Affairs essay. I've read it, and it scared the ever-living crap out of me. Giuliani in some ways scares me much more than Huckabee, but Giuliani, at least, I look and I have a sense of what his vision is for foreign policy. With Huckabee, it's almost free association, and it's intellectually contradictory free association. So I'm genuinely doubtful of the ability of a Huckabee president to actually, to actually govern foreign policy. There's going to be massive resistance if Huckabee gets the nomination. I agree with you, and I think it would be Goldwater squared. On the other hand, if Huckabee loses, it's not clear to me that the evangelicals are going to feel necessarily burdened. And in part, this depends, I think, on what Huckabee himself does. And this again goes to, I think, Huckabee's probably strongest quality, or most positive quality, which is, in fact, the relatively upbeat nature with which he campaigns. And his relative disdain, I mean, that one bizarre press conference aside, from trying to engage in negative campaigning. So my guess is if Huckabee loses, he's going to lose with relative good grace, and I don't think it's necessarily going to paralyze the Republicans. You know, there's no question that at least in this campaign, Democrats are more motivated than Republicans at this point. And unless, you know, the surge really, really works, I think that's going to hold true no matter what. But I think if Huckabee loses, it's not quite the Goddard-Dameron necessarily for the GOP.
Yeah, well, I will agree that a lot depends on how Huckabee takes it, and he could take it in either direction. On the Democratic side, I think that you're absolutely right, and I think that there will be some residual bitterness and some pretty strong bitterness among the Clinton people. But then I think one has to distinguish between two kinds of Clinton people. One, the hardcore of the supporters, and the second, which is the much broader group, which basically came on because they perceived her as being the inevitable winner, or also because the Clinton campaign made no secrets that they were keeping her friends and enemies list, and that if you screwed up when she needed you, that you were basically going to be in the doghouse for eight years. And so clearly, if you're going to see bitterness among the first group, I would suspect very strongly that you're going to see a whole bunch of the people in the second group shuffle politely over to the sides and begin to start trying to sort of get their way into a potential Obama administration. Because in large part, I think if Clinton loses this time, she's shot her bolt as a presidential candidate. This is her one and her only opportunity, and she frankly isn't going to be in the position to punish people in the way that her campaign has intimated people will be punished if she loses. So
no, that's true, and it's something we should point out, which is I think part of the reason that the campaigns have been so tense now is. You know, I mean, you and I know this, particularly among foreign policy professionals, for example. I mean, this is their careers on the line. I still remember when I was in D.C. during the 2000 campaign and the aftermath, you know, that interregnum where it wasn't clear who the president was going to be. And among the foreign policy community, I mean, blood pressures, you know, there were more heart incidents, I'm sure, during that month, because this was basically whether or not people were going to be an assistant secretary of state, deputy secretary, what have you, or whether they were going to have to go to Brookings or AEI for the next 4 years. And so it's this kind of massive uncertainty that I think frays tempers considerably. And I think that's partly what's going on. I agree with you that, you're right, there's going to be a large section of Clinton supporters who probably will be willing to... happily defect to Obama. The interesting question is whether the effect of the Clintons themselves, if they're churlish, even to the minutest degree. I mean, it is possible, however. I mean, John McCain lost to George W. Bush in 2000 and lost due to, you know, some nasty campaigning, and yet, in the end, you know, played the good soldier. And if there's nothing else, you know, the Clintons are disciplined enough politicians that they might be able to play the good soldiers. It'll be interesting to see what happens.
Yeah, while biting their tongues vigorously.
Yes.
In order to do so. On to another topic, which is, we're just talking about people talking cold and the extent to which this is possible. Well, we've seen, obviously, in the last couple of weeks, an interesting development for libertarians, where the libertarian candidate for the Republican nomination, Ron Paul, seems to be, in some measure at least, associated with a bunch of newsletters which went out under his name, and which... went beyond speaking in code to stuff which was more or less overtly racist, homophobic, and expressive of some some pretty unpleasant ideas. And, you know, there's a big question mark as to how much of this stuff, if any, Ron Paul himself wrote. People have suggested strongly in the libertarian community that Lou Rockwell, who's a well-known sort of libertarian stroke patio conservative, was responsible for a lot of this stuff. But it's an interesting question then, you know, sort of how much should Ron Paul be held to blame for the stuff which he at least passively allowed his name to be associated with back in the 1980s and early 1990s, and to what extent should he be forgiven?
Yeah, I mean, my take on this is pretty simple, which is I think he deserves a fair amount of blame. I mean, my instinct says he probably didn't write most of it, but, you know, I mean, to take a libertarian perspective on this, this was his enterprise. He owned it, I'm pretty sure. He profited from it. So, ergo, my guess is he has to also, you know, deal with the liabilities, political and otherwise, that come about from it. And, you know, I mean, if we're going to take Ron Paul seriously as a candidate, what does it say that Ron Paul, you know, ran this newsletter, was willing to put his name on it, and yet claims he never read this sort of stuff? That's not necessarily someone I want to be president, because as president you've got to have a lot of things where, you know, you oversee. It doesn't speak well necessarily for oversight, for lack of a better way of putting it. I think the thing that I find surprising is that other people were so surprised about this. If you take a look at the Reason blog particularly, and the Reason folks, who are relatively, you know, enthusiastic about, you know, the Paul campaign. Mm. You know, as someone who'd read a little bit about what Ron Paul had been arguing about in various, you know, debates and so on and so forth, this guy seemed to be much more of a conspiratorial nutcase than he did sort of a tradition or a true blue libertarian. And actually, I think this speaks to something. I mean, Jamie Kirchick, who wrote the piece, had an interesting sentence, I think, that sort of highlighted this point, which is that the libertarians who are writing for the Ron Paul newsletter are not like the, you know, I think, what was it, the urbane libertarians at the Cato Institute or the libertines at Reason Magazine. And this points up, I think, a sort of, you know, if you take a look at the genealogy of the libertarian movement, some unfortunate associations, you know, in the past, which is there's an aspect of libertarianism that, you know, just genuinely believes, you know, in you know, free markets and generally minimal state involvement, you know, based on principles of liberty. The problem is that there are also ways in which those ideas can also be used by people who, you know, advanced segregationists, who are very suspicious of large corporations, you know, the Council on Foreign Relations, the Trilateral Commission, what have you. And this gets associated with sort of libertarians who generally supported the segregationists during the Civil Rights Movement because it was associated with movements towards federalism. And this is, let's face it, a relatively unfortunate association now. Which brings up the point that, you know, is it my imagination or does basically every political party or political movement get brought down by the South? You know, the Republicans have been having to deal with this now because of, you know, coded appeals that were done during the 70s and 80s. The Democrats, of course, had a much longer history of being associated with the South, and now the Libertarians have to deal with this.
So you think this is basically an old legacy coming home for us?
Yeah, I mean, go ahead.
No, I think that's probably right. I mean, I look at somebody like Ron Paul, and my guess is too that he didn't write most of the stuff, if any of the stuff, but the fact that he let his name be associated with it, and I suspect that he did know more about it than he is letting on at the moment, also makes it seem to me that he's unfit to be president. Frankly, I think he's unfit to be an elected representative in any sort of major, serious policy-making capacity whatsoever, because these are some really, really, really nasty people. That said, I do recognize what you say, which is that there is this split in the libertarian movement between, on the one hand, the people grouped around Cato, and on the other hand, the von Mises Institute
right.
crowd, who are much more along these sort of paleoconservative lines. And maybe the way that I think about it is, I was thinking about this episode that Anne Althaus had, was it a year or 2 years ago, where she was very upset because a bunch of libertarians were talking about how they felt that anti-discrimination legislation was wrong. And the people who she was talking to were probably perfectly sincere, coming from libertarian point of view about property, about free speech and whatever, and drawing them to their logical conclusion. But there is this other crowd who don't start with the libertarian stuff, but who start with a set of political prejudices and find the libertarian language a very good way to sort of code those preferences
right.
in ways that make them seem slightly less repugnant to other human beings and who don't share that thing. And I think that's the crowd who Ron Paul directly or indirectly was associating with, was appealing to, and was, and I do think that this is one of those cases where if you lie down with dogs, you get fleas, and he really has demonstrated his unfitness for serious office. I knew some of his ideas about economics were frankly crazy beforehand, but I also have some friends who support him because of the general approach to the war, because they're libertarians who are disgusted with Bush
right.
and whatever. But I think that it's very, very hard to stay in that camp anymore. I think that he's basically he's rendered himself to be a pretty disreputable individual.
I mean, you know, it strikes me that you can almost divide. I mean, it's not a perfect divide, but libertarian attitude about the state can be divided into two kind of categories. There are libertarians who believe the state is generally inept, that, you know, for a variety of reasons, you know, rent-seeking, what have you, governments are generally not terribly efficient at what they do. The second kind of view of libertarianism is that the state is a predator, that in fact it's terribly good at coercion, and as a result it's a real serious threat to everything else. Now, I think libertarians hold both of these views to some, you know, parts of both of these views to some extent. But the Paulites and the von Mises group clearly fall into the much, you know, the latter category, to the point where it's not just that they fear the state, they fear anything that supports the state or large concentrations of power. And I think that's partly what's, you know, to give the least racist gloss I can on that kind of paleoconservative view of things. And I think, you know, to be fair, that there are aspects in which there are times where they actually have a point. I'm more intrigued by your larger question of lying down with dogs, because this raises an interesting question of when is it that someone who's trying to create an ideological movement is responsible for the fact that he or she is promoting policies that are simpatico with groups that are not terribly desirable at all. To use a foreign policy example, there's been this whole debate about, you know, the Israel lobby business and Mearsheimer and Wald and whether they're anti-Semites or not. They're not anti-Semites. Let's just get that out of the way. But clearly, the views they're articulating, anti-Semites find very sympathetic. And so to what extent do they wind up, you know, to what extent, do they wind up getting accused of lying down with dogs?
That's a judgment call, but I think it's a somewhat different issue, which is there's, how can I put it, there are, if Walton Mearsheimer had turned up at a conference run by one of the sort of various anti-Semitic crowds, and had said we don't necessarily agree with these people, but these people need to be talked to and need to be sort of part of the debate and whatever, and you can imagine the kinds of justifications. Then I think that the analogy would be a much closer.
Well, correct me if I'm wrong. This isn't the same as Lou Rockwell, but they did go to a CIAR symposium to hawk their book, correct?
That is correct, but the CAIR doesn't seem to me to be in the Lou Rockwell.
No, they're not as bad as Lou Rockwell.
There are certain things that I vigorously would disagree with them about, but it seems to me that they're they're not outside of the bounds of civilized debate.
Yeah.
In the same way that the more racist fringes of the paleoconservatives are. There are things that I vigorously disagree with them about. There are things that I find pretty reprehensible about some of the arguments that they've made. But I think I don't think that they're illegitimate in the same kind of way. I think that the broader question, this is a tough question for intellectuals, because so one of the things we have as academics, we're supposed to have this academic freedom, which is basically to pursue ideas to their logical conclusions, regardless of the consequences.
Right.
And this is something which I think is pretty important, but I also think that it can have some real difficult ethical trade-offs.
Yeah.
So if you do pursue an idea and find yourself giving credence to stuff which may sort of cause substantial social harm, I don't think that you ought to commit self-censorship, but I think that you ought to think very, very seriously about sort of the way in which you deal with it, the way in which you handle it, the way in which you behave responsibly with
right.
this in the public marketplace of opinion. But that said, you could also say the same thing about many people on the other side of the debate, that they may support ideas which promote some of the crazier people on the lunatic fringe of the Kahana.
I brought up Mearsheimer and Walt merely as an example. I agree with you. It's not unique to them. I mean, as you point out, it's a question of what obligation do you have if you're trying to push a set of ideas, and to what extent is the historical legacy of those ideas, I mean, this goes back to the Ann Althaus question, to what extent does past historical associations taint the ideas in the present day? Paul Krugman, for example, Krugman's, tried to tar and feather the Republicans with the fact that because they came to power because of the way white Southerners switched their vote, it illegitimizes what they've done to some extent, or it increases the illegitimacy. And again, with libertarians as well, this sort of thing comes up. It's not just intellectuals, it's also political movements.
Well, I think Krugman's point is actually somewhat different. If you read the book, He basically develops it considerably. It's not a sort of back in the 1960s, 1970s, the Republicans decided on the Southern strategy and whatever. His argument is that this still continues to be an important part of the effective coalition that allows the Republicans to operate as they do. And you may disagree with this on empirical grounds, or you may agree with it, but to the extent that he's right, this is an entirely legitimate criticism. I think that it's... I think that... when you have a movement which is specifically and deliberately dissociated itself from a particular set of points of view, which has basically sort of repudiated them, which has made the people who hold these points of views not part of their coalition anymore, I think at that point you're in better shape to you shouldn't fairly be criticised in the same way as other groups that have not relinquished our analysis. That's, to me, what the Ron Paul thing revolves around. And also, it doesn't seem to me that he has very effectively sought to distance himself from these people.
No, I mean, they handled this incredibly badly. Paul was almost blasé about it. He said, I didn't have any role, but it was clear he didn't care. And that was the thing that was incredibly... I think off-putting, even to the people, let's say, in Reason, who were, ideologically sympathetic to some of the things he was saying.
Yeah. Well, that brings us on to Jonah Goldberg very nicely, which is a book which I haven't read, which I have to say, sort of on the basis of the excerpts that I have read, I have no intention of reading, but which basically seeks to claim that liberals are, that there are strong continuities between liberals and fascism, and that, he doesn't quite say it in so many words, as I understand it, but that one should draw the correct conclusion, and that fascists are, in fact, a movement of the left rather than the movement of the right. And this is something which I think it's a nice illustration of this, because there's a tiny, tiny germ of historical truth to this. And this is something Sherry Berman has dealt with in her book very effectively. She's talked about how it is that many fascists were indeed socialists who went over to the other side, right. And she talks about the reasons within the socialist movement why they did this. But it's also very clear that this is something like, on a much sort of more unpleasant scale, this is something a little like the ways in which many Trotskyists of the 1960s decided to become neocons in the 1970s and 1980s. That is, let me make it emphatic. I'm not drawing any any analogies whatsoever between neocons and fascists beyond this similar movement from the left to the right, so that you can trace certain aspects of the ways in which neocons think to Trotskyite debates about the new class and whatever. Right. But to say that if you tried to claim that the neocons were a movement of the left, you'd be talking smack. And I think that Jonah Goldberg is clearly talking smack, and is talking an educated smack, but maybe you, from the base of what you've read about this, because I understand that you haven't read the book either, may have a different point of view.
I mean, we talked about this before. I mean, Ross Douthat, I think, has a post up, which suggests, look, if you're going to talk smack about the book, maybe you should read the book before talking smack about the book. I have to say that the nut paragraph that you just described, of Goldberg's argument, what I keep wondering is, well, why would you even bother writing a book like that if you can just go back and read Road to Serfdom, which in some ways, is not exactly that kind of argument, but there's an element of that, which is, this slippery slope, once you engage in, this kind of well-meaning liberal behavior, down the road, totalitarianism-wise. So it's not clear to me what the value added of Goldberg's book is. Except I suppose bringing it up to date. Beyond that, as you point out, the thing is that there's a grain of truth to this, I'm uncomfortable talking about books that I haven't read yet, at least haven't read, at least excerpts from. But one of the things I have to wonder is, perhaps, is he talking about the ideas or is he talking about the mindset? And this actually goes to the point that you were making about Trotskyites and neocons, which is you have to wonder if there's almost a personality that seems attracted to certain sets of ideas, regardless of their political orientation, but because of the thought process and the conclusion it leads to, which is it provides some kind of clarity of action.
I think there is a personality, but I don't think, at least from what I've read in the way of excerpts, that there's much of that kind of argument. I think Goldberg's argument is more along the lines of, you know, sort of Hitler was a vegetarian, and vegetarianism and various aspects of this this good food culture were part of Nazism. We look today and we look at liberals who seem to love their sort of organic foods. Isn't this an interesting revealing comparison kind of,
Kind of a logical absurdity.
Yeah.
All vegetarians are vegetarians, therefore all vegetarians must be dictators.
There's a certain degree of logical slippage there.
Yeah.
And in response to Ross's point, I think that it's well taken, at least to an extent, that you should read books before dissing them. But first of all, there's pretty good evidence that Goldberg himself, when he was compiling this book, didn't do so. He wrote a pretty notorious blog post where he said that there were a lot he would have to read a lot of Herbert Spencer in order to write this book. He didn't want to read Herbert Spencer. Basically, was there anybody out there who's willing to provide him with the Cliff Notes version of what Herbert Spencer would have to say about this stuff? And if he pretends to do the research for this kind of stuff, I don't see any reason why he should do more than pretend to actually read the book. But more generally, I think it's like you get on sort of LaRouche's, every day when I used to live in DuPont Circle, I used to get approached by LaRoucheites who used to try and get me to read their stuff, and I would say no, and they would say, if you give it a chance to read it, you'll find it revealing, and you know damn well that you're going to find crazy lunatic stuff inside there. And frankly, Jonah Goldberg is not the kind of person who you would expect to be able to write a book like this with any degree of sophistication, with any degree of intelligence, with any degree of ability to see that there are two sides to this particular story. So I'm probably less sympathetic to Ross in this than I would be otherwise. And I also think, why do you want to protect somebody who is clearly not one of the, not one of the first magnitude stars in the intellectual firmament of the conservative movement? Why is it that people like Jonah Goldberg or Podhoretz Jr. or whoever should be representing the conservative movement? I think there's something wrong with a movement that has these people as its major spokespeople.
Well, I don't know if I would call them as major spokespeople. I mean, they're spokespeople. And you're right. Well, there is something a little disturbing about the fact that we're talking about sort of second generation, as if it's a dynastic kind of story. I mean, I guess I've blown hot and cold on Goldberg over the years. I think he makes some interesting points every once in a while. Let me put it this way: I guess I take him seriously enough so that I would want to read the book before deciding, yeah, this is probably crap, there might be the germ of an interesting point. I don't put him in the Ann Coulter category can automatically dismiss. My take is, I want to read the book before, articulating a more serious viewpoint. As to the larger question about the state of the intellectual right, I mean, look, there's no, I think that state there, is clearly a function of the right actually having been in power for, 10 years or so, and stretching back to Reagan, at least having some kind of, influence for the past 30 years. It's not terribly shocking that the intellectual movement has kind of run its course, much like, the Democrats, from about the New Deal coalition to about the late 60s, ran aground as well. I am kind of intrigued. I think Rehan Salam and Ross Douthat actually are going to have a book coming out on where the right should go, from here on in. And I think this is one of those times where occasionally, having a moment out of power is, being out of power is good for ideas because it allows people to think more freely. And so the less I think that conservatives are attached to government as a libertarian, this might actually be a good thing for the promotion or articulation of new sets of ideas. I think we'll see what happens going forward. But I think my take on Goldberg is that because I haven't read the book, I'm going to give him, the due respect of saying I need to read the book in order to take it seriously. So, but I want to move on.
Okay, well, I guess my take is, as my co-blogger Daniel Davies said, he's not so much in need of intellectual charity as an intellectual Marshall Plan. But clearly we're going to disagree on that. And
yeah.
I guess, yes, read the book, and maybe next time we talk about this, we can actually have a further conversation.
Right. Okay.
So,
why don't we talk about to go back to the campaign for a second? Do you mind talking about the soft power business?
Yeah. Go ahead.
Yeah. I mean, the one thing, as much as we've talked about the negatives of the campaign, you know, the race gender business, Ron Paul's association with racists, what have you. One of the things I find intriguing, there was a Washington Post story about this over the weekend, is that this election is generating not just a lot of interest within the United States, but it's generating massive amounts of interest overseas. And that because of the wide open nature of the race, you know, people are paying much more attention now than they would normally. In traditional previous campaigns, people would start to pay attention, say, October, but now, because the primaries have been relatively exciting, people are paying attention now. And the question is, you know, there's been a lot of debates about, you know, the idea of soft power, the idea of, you know, America's image abroad, and that this can be, you know, if it's a positive image, it can be a net asset for U.S. foreign policy, and that soft power has taken a beating during the George W. Bush years. And the assumption was that whoever was going to be president was probably going to be an improvement in terms of promoting soft power. But one of the interesting questions is whether the campaign itself, because it's been relatively vigorous, and because the candidates, and there can be only one in the end, but a lot of them are relatively attractive, whether the campaign itself will also promote a more positive view of the U.S. abroad.
I think that there's a reasonable chance of that, but I think that it's, to the extent that you're right, I think it's a product of what's been happening on the Democratic rather than the Republican side. So if I look at what's happening on the Republican side, it seems to me that that there's a kind of a race to the intellectual and ideological bottom happening, which is, you know, sort of somebody says, I'll keep Guantanamo Bay open for 50 years. Another guy says, no, I'll keep it open for 100. You know, so you get, with the exception of John McCain, the sort of the torture porn element of the Republican debate, I think, is extremely disturbing. A whole bunch of stuff and a whole bunch of things which have been said, Mitt Romney on role of Christianity and the conspicuous lack of any mention of Islam. I think there's been a whole bunch of stuff there which has not been helpful for the image of the U.S. abroad. And I suspect that if we get that dynamic happening in the general election for the presidency, we're going to get a lot of problems as a result of that. But I do think that what's been happening on the Democratic side has had some pretty interesting implications, you know, because you get Obama versus Clinton, and you get, you know, for the first time in the last few years, and this is really, I think, beginning to accelerate even the last day or two, you're beginning to get a real debate beginning to emerge on what happened in Iraq, on what the broad contours of an American approach should be. And I think we're going to move on from some of the generalities, I hope, which we've seen in the various foreign affairs essays that the candidates have written, to something which is sharper in the way of debate, which I think may actually have the positive consequences you're talking about.
Well, all right, let me defend the GOP for a second, since that's my role. I mean, I will concede the point that debating about, you know, who's going to be tougher on immigration and the Guantanamo issue, probably not the strongest side of the GOP. On the other hand, hearing the Democrats try to outdo each other on who's going to be toughest in terms of trade protectionism, also not necessarily the best way to project, you know, U.S. openness abroad. So I'm not sure it's entirely a GOP tick. On the other hand, I mean, you know, the Republican who's done relatively well in the primaries, you know, John McCain, I think actually has he's perceived much more favorably abroad. And second, this is where I think Huckabee, interestingly enough, this is the one thing I like about Huckabee, which is he's a relatively nice guy, and he's actually relatively funny. And so, to some extent, he might be thought of as someone who, for lack of a better way of putting it, makes evangelicals seem less scary. He's not the fire and brimstone kind of, you know, it's all about Sodom and Gomorrah outside. You know, he's able to put a friendly face on the evangelicals, and that might not necessarily be a bad thing. Furthermore, because Mitt Romney is a Mormon, and that's interesting, you know, it's sort of, you know, again, a side of America's diversity in some ways overseas. So I think that the GOP, while I'm not thrilled with the tenor about the immigration side, I agree, I don't think the GOP side will necessarily be as bad. I mean, my dream, I guess, you know, not my dream. It'll be interesting to see, I think, who the GOP winner is. My guess is that if it's McCain, you know, a McCain-Clinton or a McCain-Obama race will actually be, I think, pretty interesting and will potentially generate useful stuff for overseas. But I also think the way the campaign has gone to date has also benefited Americans or the perception of Americans. Because among other things, going negative hasn't helped anyone. On the GOP side, Romney's been the one who's been attacking everyone, and the result is that he hasn't. The only thing he's won was the Wyoming caucus. Huckabee, you know, decided was originally thinking about going negative and then stayed upbeat, and he won Iowa. McCain, who's I think the Republican who gets the best image overseas, you know, wins New Hampshire. I mean, we'll see what happens going forward. But the candidates who are seen as, you know, potentially more negative, I think Romney and Giuliani are also the ones who are fading, relatively speaking, in the Republican campaign. Similarly, I think that the Democrat campaign as well, you know, it was when there were attacks on Hillary that Hillary is, you know, suddenly did better. And my suspicion is Hillary's about to pay a price for the attacks that were made on Obama. Mm-hmm. So I think the competitive nature of the primary, you know, the primaries itself, plus the fact that negative campaigning doesn't seem to work for both sides, I think is a net gain for the United States.
Well, on the McCain thing, I think one part of that is at least to some extent true. I think he's less likely to engage in a kind of dirty politics than, say, Rudy Giuliani, who looked to be the likely Republican nominee a couple of months ago.
Right.
But I also think that some of McCain's positive image abroad is frankly because people abroad don't understand exactly what he stands for and the specific associations he has with foreign policy. You know, if you go back to 2000, the original neocons were not signing on with George W.
They were signing on with John McCain.
They were
McCain.
All pushing the yep. McCain candidacy, Bill Kristol and people, and for the very good reason that they perceived him as being the person who was most in line with their point of view on foreign policy. Now, clearly there's been some divergences since, again, especially over the issue of torture, where while I think McCain could have played a much more proactive role, he at least hasn't signed on directly in the way that many other Republicans have. But when you see him say things like, you know, sort of somebody asks him a question about whether we're going to be in Iraq for another 50 years, and he says, no, it's, you know, sort of, I'm going to go up to 100 years, you know, that's not necessarily the kind of thing that is going to win him friends and influence people outside, because frankly, I think the perception of the world opinion, insofar as there is such a thing as world opinion, is that the U.S. and sort of willingness to jump in wholesale into other societies to try and remake them has been an almighty and unmitigated disaster. And I don't know that John McCain has absorbed this point in any real way. My worry is that if he did become elected president, that he would he would engage in other forms of adventurism, which I think would have a disastrous effect not only for the American public opinion for public opinion about America and the world, but also for America and for the world.
I don't know. I mean, to defend McCain. I mean, again, not to necessarily endorse him either, but to defend him. First of all, the 100-year line. I'm sorry, that's just been way overblown in my opinion. I find that a crock. Because my understanding is the way it was, McCain said it in the context of assuming the Iraqi government wanted them to stay. And furthermore, you know, just having some kind of presence. It's worth pointing out, we've been in Germany now for more than 60 years. We've been in Japan for more than 60 years. We've been in Korea for more than 50. So it's not like this is terribly unprecedented as far as what McCain's talking about. So I don't think he was talking about staying there in the same way that the current, you know, U.S. troops are. This is assuming that we actually have a viable Iraq government and some kind of you know, viable state that actually just wants us to maintain a more minimal presence. Second, you know, if you take a look at where McCain talks about intervening, and he did this in Europe, I might add, because I heard him speak live at this point, he's talking about intervening in places like Darfur, you know, which not necessarily, you know, that might actually draw a fair amount of sympathy from, you know, a fair slice of the world that accuses, you know, the U.S. and other established powers of only caring about, let's say, strategic parts of the globe. So I would disagree. I mean, I think McCain is looked at certainly as someone who wants to pursue a more activist foreign policy and potentially, you know, use U.S. force in ways that, you know, certainly more comfortable with the use of U.S. force. But, you know, on the other hand, he's trying to address trouble spots that, let's face it, it's not like pre-existing, you know, or the status quo is necessarily terribly wonderful either. I mean, you're right. I think he's got he does have the millstone of Iraq tied around his neck. But I also think McCain deserves some credit for, you know, endorsing the surge strategy at a time when it was clearly politically costly to do so. I mean, that cost him the front-runner status, in my opinion. And yet, you know, 9 months later, no, the surge hasn't produced, you know, magical results. But there's no doubt that life in Iraq is considerably better in terms of security now than it was a year ago. They just passed a law, you know, dealing with Abathis, although we'll see what, you know, what that amounts to. And at least the surge has accomplished the military goal of hopefully creating a political space. Now, whether that political opportunity will be seized by the Iraqis is another question entirely. But again, I mean, this is... I think that, you know, he deserves credit for sticking to a position that was unpopular at the time, that cost him politically, and now hopefully, you know, interestingly enough, we'll see if he reaps the world, you know, the benefit from it.
Yeah, well, I frankly, I have strong doubts as to whether that kind of interventionist policy is going to be possible in the same way for the U.S. without paying a major cost in public opinion in the future, whether it's McCain, whether it would be Obama, whether it would be Clinton. But
no, and I concur with that. I mean, this is not going to be an easy sell in a general election. And it'll be interesting to see what happens once you get to a general election about debates about the use of force.
Yeah, I have to go now,
Okay.
So maybe we can wrap it up here.
Absolutely. Pleasure as always.
All right, great to talk to you.
Okay, take care. Bye.
Okay, bye.